And good morning to everyone. The first case this morning is Skyline Woods Homeowners Association, Inc. versus Brockemeyer Paisley LLC versus Liberty Building Corporation. Mr. Domina, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Liberty Building Corporation and David and Robin Brockemeyer, who are the defendants in two cases consolidated for briefing and argument before this Court. One of those cases presents a jurisdiction issue. You have submissions recently made on that issue affecting your subject matter jurisdiction. I'd like to simply be clear for a moment about that. After we received this Court's order to show cause issued in the Paisley case for the reason that there was a trespass claim asserted in the complaint in that case not adjudicated below, the District Court was approached for an order nunc pro tunc. That order was issued. It declared that Section 251315 was intended to be invoked so that the portion of the Paisley case that is common to the Skyline case is a final order. We think that solves the jurisdiction issue before you. We are now in the 30-day period of time for filing a notice of appeal after Paisley dismissed that lingering trespass claim, which it did after the nunc pro tunc order was issued. So we'll have to file another notice of appeal with you within the next approximate 3 weeks. And I anticipate that the parties at that time will stipulate that that new appeal to protect the question of jurisdiction in Paisley should be submitted on the briefs and the argument today, although that's an odd procedure because the appeal isn't here yet. I say that to you so that you are forewarned of that if there's an issue about it.
Mr. Domina, you discussed with the Court at the time they were entering the order about putting in a certification, did you not?
I raised that issue, Your Honor.
And it just never got in there?
It just never got in there, that's correct. And I don't think there's more I need to say about that. That's a matter of fact, Your Honor.
Was it ruled on? Did the trial court comment on the certification?
No, the trial court didn't comment on the certification, Your Honor. The trial court simply issued its order later, and I don't know if the trial court thought ill of my suggestion at that time or simply overlooked it when the summary judgment was in fact issued. But that's what happened. There was an attempt made, an uncontested attempt made by counsel for the parties to bring that issue to the trial court because we foresaw the problem that you identified in your order to show cause. And unfortunately, the trial court didn't remediate the problem.
Well, my question goes a little bit to the office of the non-proton to fix something meant to do.
I understand that argument thoroughly, and I think that you addressed it in Mid-America Financial Corporation versus Eicher.
The court entered the non-proton.
Right.
Must not have thought too ill of your argument or suggestion.
I think that's right, and I think that counsel here felt more comfortable with that approach because of the way this court handled Mid-America Financial versus Eicher. May I turn to the merits now if there are no more questions about subject matter jurisdiction? This is a case in which, as the court knows, the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Nebraska issued an order, which is Exhibit 44, in which the court directed that a trustee in bankruptcy sell real estate the trustee owned, consisting of a golf course that had failed several times previously and had failed a final time leading to bankruptcy. The trustee did sell the property. The bankruptcy court's order directing a sale free and clear also directed that the trustee issue title by deed, and that deed recites the authority of the trustee to deliver title free and clear under the bankruptcy court's order. The entire purpose of the bankruptcy proceeding was to attempt to put back into productive use a parcel of real estate that had been dedicated to a use that had failed financially more than once. It had failed in its effort to be employed as a golf course nearby a residential development in the western part of the Omaha metropolitan area. So after the bankruptcy court's order, the sale was made in a public proceeding. The purchasers bought the property with the intention that they would develop the property for residential purposes. This is not a case in which the intended use is hostile to the existing use of the neighbors. But the neighbors took the position in state court that they had a right, notwithstanding the order that the property was sold free and clear of all interests, of all parties, in an in rem proceeding in bankruptcy. They took the position in state court that they had an implied easement requiring that the property be remain a golf course to perpetuity. They issued, they asserted other claims which they lost on summary judgment that are not before you. That's the claim that's here. The claim asserted arises from two documents, Exhibits 31 and 41A. Exhibit 31 is a memorandum filed with the Register of Deeds in Douglas County that makes a reference in its recital provisions, which are incorporated by reference into its text, to an April 6, 1990 contract for the purchase and sale of real estate. Exhibit 41A is the April 6, 1990 contract, or at least a part of it. 56 pages of it are present. It indicates in its text, in those 56 pages, that there were a series of exhibits, at least through Exhibit H, that are absent. And it indicates that there were a number of conditions to be performed as conditions precedent to the closing foretold by the contract. Absent from the record is proof that the closing occurred under the terms of the agreement. The agreement is not filed of record. And we know that it was not filed of record because Exhibit 229 is an affidavit of an abstractor that certifies exactly what was filed of record and makes it clear that the contract was not.
Is paragraph 9.2, is that the flashpoint paragraph?
I think it is, Your Honor. Paragraph 9.2, which is on page 35, is about a covenant that the buyer subsequent to closing would maintain the golf course. That is the issue.
And that was not recorded, that agreement?
It was not. It was not recorded, and I believe it's fair to say that there is no evidence that the closing, there was a sale, ever occurred under the terms that would make that provision mandatory. The argument is that that language creates this implied covenant that there will be a golf course to perpetuity. Exhibit 229 is the abstractor certificate if you need more about the title. This is our position.
I'm sorry, did you say implied covenant or implied easement?
Well, it's called both by the appellees. I think it's more fairly called an implied easement, Your Honor. I think their argument is that they have a right to control the use of our property, which essentially gives them an easement that encumbers our real estate.
Runs with the land.
They contend it runs with the land. We're not aware of any reference to that document in their titles. Our argument here is that, number one, the bankruptcy court determined that it had subject matter jurisdiction in its in rem proceeding to sell this property free and clear of all liens, and that 11 U.S.C. Section 363 authorized that sale. The bankruptcy court's order was a final order. It was not appealed. The appellees say that order did not bind them because they were not parties to the bankruptcy proceeding. The bankruptcy statute upon which the court relied in ordering the trustee to sell says that a sale may be made free and clear of all interests in the asset to be sold. And interest is a defined term under the bankruptcy code. The term interest in an in rem proceeding in bankruptcy is broad enough so it covers the interests of persons who assert that they have an interest in real estate, whether they are parties or not. That is the nature.
Suppose, would a bankruptcy court wipe out the zoning? That's also a restriction on use. Would it wipe out zoning, and you could put a McDonald's in the middle of Regency if you bought the house out of a bankruptcy?
There are decisions, Your Honor, that address that very question and generally say that the answer is no. A bankruptcy court cannot eradicate zoning, which is a matter of law. And generally speaking, those cases appear to parse this word interests.
What would be the difference between zoning and a restrictive covenant?
Well, at least this is what I think the judges who have looked at that and written on that subject have attempted to say. They've attempted to say that when the government imposes a burden on land, through land use restrictions, that creates no interest except the public's interest. And the public's interest is not eradicated in bankruptcy. That same thing, for example, saves a utility easement, which would not be eradicated in a sale by a trustee, because that is an easement in the public interest that affects others.
You're not saying that the bankruptcy court's order would eradicate a recorded covenant that's on the land?
I am not, Your Honor. Not unless it was the subject of a bona fide controversy, which is one of the prongs of Section 363F. Then it could be eradicated because of the
adjudicator. Well, what would you describe the interest of the landowners in this purchase agreement?
What was their interest?
Yeah. Well, should they have been notified in the bankruptcy court of the proceedings?
Well, number one, the purchaser's interest was an interest in acquiring fee simple, subject to some restrictions in the contract. Number two, we don't know if the buyer ever had any interest in title at the time of the bankruptcy. The buyer wasn't the bankrupt party. So there was a subsequent conveyance of the real estate that is simply absent from these proceedings, and we don't know about that. Number three, we don't know if the buyer was notified in the bankruptcy proceeding or participated, based on what we have in this record. All we know is that the bankruptcy proceeding was an in rem proceeding, and that the bankruptcy court adjudicated the scope of its authority and the scope of its required notice. And we think that's sufficient to dispose of the issues here. But our second argument is this. Under our statutes, even if the bankruptcy court had not appropriately issued its order, the memorandum, Exhibit 31, is not adequate to give notice of the unrecorded contract, Exhibit 41A. And that's true because our Section 76245.04 says that where an instrument is required to be recorded, a reference to it in another document purporting to incorporate it by reference is insufficient. And that's the best that we have here for the appellees to rely on under state law. So we think they lose either way.
Your client had actual notice. In fact, he was selling Ranchview Estates right next door and advertising, you got a view of the golf course. He's got an actual notice. This is a golf course, right?
Absolutely, he knew it had been used as a golf course.
How does that fit in?
To
making him a good faith purchaser, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Your Honor, I think it fits in only to this extent. Anybody buying a parcel of real estate used for a prior use can observe what the use is and can intend to use it for a new purpose if that new purpose is lawful. Otherwise, we would have no change and real estate would be stagnant. It's the long-standing policy of the law to make real estate productively used. That's why we have the doctrine of adverse possession, for example. So the fact that he knew that it had been a golf course is not notice that there was any easement right or covenant right that ran to the adjoining landowners, any more than knowing that the Lincoln Country Club is a golf course imparts notice to this court that the adjoining property owners have an interest in.
Does the record show what was the zoning of this property, of the golf course itself?
I don't remember if that's a matter of record. I'm sorry. I don't think it's a relevant concern. May I reserve my remaining time for rebuttal, Your Honor?
You may.
Thank you.
Sheritz, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jim Sheritz on behalf of the appellees in this case, who will fall into four broad classifications. There is the one that was mentioned by the panel just a moment ago, and that is one of Mr. Brockmeyer's buyers paid a premium because Mr. Brockmeyer advertised and told him, you're buying a lot that's on a golf course. He's one of our plaintiffs. He's one of the people that's saying, Mr. Brockmeyer, you can't stop this being a golf course. I paid a premium for that benefit. The rest are homeowners associations for the two sections where their homes built, some who had golf course contracts with Mr. Brockmeyer saying they could play, and then the vast majority are homeowners that live in this area. And last night, I'm certain when many were across the country angry with or happy with Sarah Palin's historic speech, there were 90 homes filled with people that were scared to death about what's going to happen in this case. Because you have homes that look out onto this purported golf course that's been there since the 60s, that in not one, but in 10 reported documents, there's a reference to the golf course. Exhibits 22, 23, 25 through 29, 31, 41A, 41B, and at least three promotional materials that are in evidence that the developer gave to people saying, this is going to be a golf course that you're paying a premium to live on. Now, Mr. Brockmeyer, knowing it was a golf course, selling lots himself on an abutting subdivision, promising people they'd have a view of a golf course, Brockmeyer comes in and buys not a bankrupt course, it was a prepackaged Chapter 11. The undisputed evidence is this golf course was making a positive cash flow of $400,000 a year. Mr. Brockmeyer managed to turn that on its head because the day after closing, he fired 300 members, over 220 golf members and other social members, and decided he didn't need them anymore. Still ran it as a golf course for a year, and then a year later decided to shut it down, began to cut down trees, let the grass grow to 2 feet tall, allowed skunks and brown spiders and other vermin to be there, created a fire hazard that a former fire marshal said could result in a conflagration that could destroy those homes and kill dozens of people because he just decided he wanted to change the use. Now, when he wanted to change the use, he never once talked to an architect or an engineer, never once applied for a rezoning in the 2 years that he owned it before the suit was filed, or the year and a half. And in fact, the testimony is from the former number two person in the Omaha Planning Department that has zoning jurisdiction, and from a former mayor, Mr. Morgan, who's also experienced in the brokerage of such properties, that it would be preposterous to assume he could get the rezoning necessary to develop this for something other than a golf course. Officials also testified it would be highly unlikely that he would get the necessary curb cuts onto abutting Highway 92 and 275 to develop this, not in what Mr. Domina suggests are compatible uses, but rather commercial uses that he said that he wanted to develop it into. He's never going to be able to do that.
What document do you rely on that claim requires that this land remain in perpetuity as a golf course?
First, there are the 10 exhibits that I referred to just a moment ago that coupled with the overall master plan of development show by clear implication, whether it be negative reciprocal easement, negative reciprocal servitude, implied easement, implied covenant, or otherwise, as the Nebraska Supreme Court has said, and as the Arizona Court of Appeals said in Shalimar, it's implied. But there's an explicit provision in 9.2 that's incorporated by reference. We've all seen circumstances where a lease is referred to by a memorandum of record.
But how would the buyer ever know about 9.2?
Well, it puts
because
on inquiry.
That document was never recorded.
Puts on inquiry notice, and it was recorded, a reference to it was recorded in 90 and again in 97 in the exhibits. It puts on inquiry notice, and the evidence says they made no inquiry, made no attempt to find the document that had the express covenant.
Well, how could they find the document?
Well, it was in the possession of the seller, the precision bearing people who had sold this property for some $6 million. That document was in their possession. They were referenced on the memorandum. Anybody who wanted to find it could have made an inquiry. That's what it's called, inquiry notice, constructive notice. They never made the inquiry. When we did, because we're not precision bearing, we're the homeowners, we found it. And we put it in front of people. But you don't even need to go that far. Our courts, this body has said in Horst, in the recitals to restatement third of property, Normandy Square, Mysick, and in Wessel, that when there's a scheme or plan of development that shows that there's going to be a certain type of amenity or benefit, then everybody knows that and they're burdened by it. The case law clearly shows if the original developer had tried to convert the use of this golf course after selling lots on it, he would have absolutely been stopped cold.
Assuming you establish the burden here, what is the effect of the bankruptcy order?
In the cases that we cite to, I think perhaps the best one is the Eighth Circuit quoting in the Oyster Cove case, where it says the sale free and clear of liens and other interests has no impact on restrictions of record that run with the land. Free and clear should be interpreted as speaking of interest against the property such as liens and mortgages, but it goes on to say it is not intended to sever easements and other non-monetary property interests created by substantive state law.
Does that refer to recordings of easements and mortgages?
No, and in fact, when you refer specifically to 363F under the Bankruptcy Code under Title 11, the burdens on the land that exist under state law cannot be impacted or changed by the bankruptcy court. That's
even
Section 8.
Even though they're not recorded?
Well, in fact, we have 10 recordings here because you have to look at the common development. There are recordings 10 of them against the property owners that abut the golf course. And any title policy, for example, you're charged with notice of the rights of those in possession or those of abutting property owners.
Sorry, it's 10 references.
Yes. Well, it's 10 different documents. We go back to...
And recorded things that refer to the interest that you claim.
Refer to a golf course in one manner or another, in addition to the obvious notice. Anybody, including Mr. Brockmeyer, who was selling lots that he said had a view of this course.
Would a title examiner have been referred to to record these documents in examining title?
I think that clearly they would have, and in the title policy here, the 1990 and 1997 recordings that have reference to the memorandum that puts them on inquiry notice were in the title report. That's clearly in evidence. There's no question about that.
That's one of those things noted in the report, is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Given your argument, what would happen if the property owner of the golf course decided, I don't want to operate this as a golf course?
I think when you stick your neck out and buy a piece of property that's been operated as a golf course, you have to understand that there are implied covenants, easements, servitudes that are going to impact that property. Courts in South Carolina, California, Arizona, New Mexico, and in a park case in Nebraska, I believe it's the Wessel case, have said if there's a scheme of development, you can't just abandon it. In the Nebraska case, the developer took what had been in promotional materials referred to as a park and tried to convert it to apartments, and the court stopped it and said the people that live here bought with anticipation of that amenity.
Is there a difference between operate as a golf course and maintain as a golf course? In other words, mow the fairways and have it look nice, but don't care whether anybody's playing golf or not.
Excellent point. That goes to our cross appeal. Is while the court has said you have to make it look like a golf course or a well-kept lawn, I believe is the phrase, we think the court did not go as far as it could and should have. Courts in other jurisdictions, including California and Arizona, have said you bought it knowing it was a golf course, it had been operated as a golf course, people's homes have been developed with that view in the backyard. In fact, our experts said the backyards are typically smaller on a golf course because they impute the area of the fairways into the backyard to make people feel like they have a big yard when in fact they have a small one. As a result of all that, they entered orders that in one case, mandated in the Shalimar case out of Arizona, that they had to operate it as a golf course. In a California case, they entered a equitable lien and said, we're going to be, in effect, fining you so much per month until you or somebody starts operating this as a golf course again. And that
what do the homeowners care whether it's operated as?
Well, here's the problem.
They want to look out and it looks nice.
But here's the problem. We've already had three contempts below. There's another one that's coming up on appeal. There's another one that's pending in the district court because the district court retains the power to enforce its orders notwithstanding an appeal. This guy's not maintaining the property. He mows it every now and then when there's a contempt filed. He has never turned the sprinklers on since his suit was filed. Thank goodness we've had enough rain it hasn't burned up completely. There have been weeds, the ponds are filled with scum, and there's ample evidence of that, and that's why the court entered the original order. If the owners of this, including its lender that provided 100% financing, are not told it must be in fact operated as a golf course, or there'll be some negative consequences, a lien as one of the California decisions did, then they're not going to. And these homeowners will not get the benefit of the bargain that they had.
Well, what relief of putting a lien, how does that better the homeowner?
It creates an economic incentive for the owner of this course and his lender to retain it or put it back to its original use, its original purpose and function. If they're not compelled to do that, we'll have to wait for them to go broke. And the people who bought pursuant to this common scheme and master plan will not get what they were bargaining for and what was promised to them.
Would the lien have a practical effectiveness in the contempt?
Well, he's defending the contempt by saying, I don't have the money to fix this. And in fact, what's happening is he's paying about $20,000 or $25,000 a month to his lender for this and other land loans in the general area.
So you think a lien would force the issue, at least in terms of the lender?
It would force the issue. It would force the lender either to step up and do something, or its interest would also be and should be subject to this obligation. As the evidence shows, the lender knew of the same title restrictions, the same 10 items. And as a consequence, they should be burdened by them as well.
There's a report by title investigators or whatever, is that right, from 90 and 97, that's in the record?
Yes. I'd like to reserve the balance of time, if I could, for Mr. Wang, who has related arguments. Thank you. No further questions.
How much time do we have?
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Wang.
Good morning. My name is Jim Lang. I'm the attorney for Paisley LLC. Paisley is a limited liability company that owns 9.66 acres of vacant ground within the Skyline Woods Country Club. Paisley bought this ground in 2005. At the time it purchased the ground, the adjoining property was used as a golf course. It was being operated as a golf course. This particular ground is vacant ground, but it would be another phase for residential development, similar to the two phases that are out there now. One thing I would like to go back to on the argument in relative to the bankruptcy court's order, where it ordered the property be conveyed free and clear. Under Section 363F of the Bankruptcy Act, there are five elements that the statute looks at where the bankruptcy court, can sell the property free and clear. None of those five situations exist in this situation. Only two could possibly apply. Number two, which is consent of the entities, which did not happen, and number four, which is an adjudication of the interest of the parties. In this situation, these property owners, Paisley and the Skyline Woods Homeowner Association, have a property interest. It's their interest in these restrictive covenants. It's not the interest of the debtor. Therefore, in order for that interest to be eradicated under 363F, there must be either an adjudication or consent, and that did not happen in this particular case. The district court cited a case of Oyster Bay Cove in its order where it discussed this specific situation, which really is right on point in this particular situation. And basically that involved a easement, and it said the bankruptcy court could not order the sale of the property free and clear unless it complied with 363F, and it did not. In our brief at page 12, we cite the case of 523 East 5th Street Housing Preservation Development, which is a restrictive covenant case. In this case, the court said that a restrictive covenant is a right running with the land of the property owners. It is not an interest of the debtor, and therefore it can only be eliminated once again under 363F, under one of the five elements, none of which exist here. Referring back to the covenant issue, and we talk about, as Mr. Sheritz, we have these implied and express covenants. We have the express covenants, which are recorded against the property, and we have the implied covenants, which consist of the master plan scheme of development, which consists of a platting, which consists of the physical appearance of the ground. We have an overall scheme of development here that has been represented to these property owners.
Is there platting which shows that this is a golf course?
Yes, it does.
Or is the platting saying lot such and such in the homes surrounding the golf course?
The platting, if you look at the plat, you can see there's two basically developed areas. There's several lots, two pods of lots. Intermingled with the lots is the golf course. You can tell by physically looking at the particular plat that it is a golf course development. Much of the literature that was submitted to the potential buyers with the plat shows the, and these are exhibits in the case, shows the golf course development. The plat itself would have lots or numbers for the platted lots, and the lot itself, the golf course.
But this isn't zoned as a golf course or in the master plan as a golf course, is it?
The master plan certainly shows this as a golf course. It's zoned, I believe the zoning is what we call DR, Developmental Reserve, which is a reserve type of residential development, which is consistent with golf course type developments. And then the lots are zoned residential. Now, DR is a residential type of zoning development, consistent with golf courses, and it would be the type of zoning that you would utilize for a golf course.
Are you saying that anyone who purchases this property that's subject to this covenant, which may or may not be recorded, must operate this particular parcel of ground as a golf course and continue to do so until they either sell it to someone else for that purpose or until they become broke and have no money left to
to sustain the operation of that course.
Yeah, we are saying that because of the express and implied covenants and the scheme of development that has occurred and the representations that have been presented, the particular owner of this property can only utilize, maintain, and operate this property as a golf course.
Well, you're arguing that if he doesn't operate it as a golf course, he has to maintain it as if it were a golf course, regardless of whether or not anybody plays golf on it or whether or not it generates any revenue.
Right. We agree.
Can't make it into houses or anything else.
That's correct. Those, this particular, the development and the scheme of development is binding upon the Skyline Woods property owners and Paisley, and also upon Liberty Development and any subsequent buyer of the golf course. If you look at the different documents, one of which is this memorandum of understanding, it has a very comprehensive description of the golf course development. It talks about developing lots. It talks about the golf course itself. And that document is the one that refers to the purchase agreement with the restriction. But that document also says that these documents run with the land and they're binding upon all subsequent buyers. We have a common scheme of development. It's binding upon the property owners and Liberty Development.
So as a practical matter, following up on Justice Wright's question, what if somebody goes insolvent and it's impossible to operate it as a going golf course? The relief you want is that it cannot be developed as housing or as a subdivision. Is that correct?
The property...
I mean, the court can't make somebody do something impossible.
I understand that, Your Honor.
So what is the relief that you're really looking at?
The relief we're looking at in this case is what Judge Battalion has entered, number one, Your Honor, is that it be maintained. If it's going to be utilized, it must be utilized as a golf course. And if the person that owns it cannot financially operate it as a golf course, then it must be maintained as a golf course in the same fashion. Also, we are asking in our cross appeal, as Mr. Schert stated, and we think this court has the authority to do so, is to issue a mandatory injunction. We feel the district court was remiss in not doing so. Issue a mandatory injunction requiring it be operated as a golf course or leased as a golf course. Liberty Development.
And then if the owner can't do those things on injunction, what happens?
If the owner can't do those things, the restriction remains that this property, based upon the covenants that run to the adjoining owner, must be maintained in the fashion of a golf course.
By whom?
By the property.
By the guy's broke?
By the property owner. We, in this
so you expect the property owner can't do it economically or has to get the money from the loans that are secured by this property and then the lender comes in and does the property?
Right. It's no different than any other piece of property owned by anyone else. If you own a house in the city of Omaha and you don't keep that house up, the city of Omaha has authority to come in there and require you to do so, and if it does, they can go through a condemnation procedure to require you to do so, and if you don't, they can acquire the house and sell it.
But the house it's tore down, it's over with. I mean, there's no more affirmative action that needs to be done by the city.
But the property remains, it'd be a similar situation. The property remains there, and the question is what needs to be done with the property. But that particular property that I described, the residential property, the house gets torn down, that particular lot, because it's zoned residential, and because there's probably covenants against that, has to maintain as a residential lot. So it's just because the owner comes up and says, I can make more money if I use this as a commercial lot and put a 7-Eleven on there, which he probably can, that doesn't permit him to do so. It's the same situation here. You have a property owner coming in here, buying a piece of property that's required to use it for specific use, similar to a zoning situation. If he cannot use it for that specific use, that should not damage the adjoining property owners That is his concern. He's a property owner. As a property owner, you have certain obligations, as any property owner has. If you don't comply with those obligations, you are in danger of losing your property. It comes into the hands of another property owner, which is not uncommon. That property owner then can go ahead and utilize that property for which it is intended to be utilized. There are properties out there, because of the restrictions and zoning and covenants, that do go through a process of, let's say, foreclosure. But just because a particular property owner struggles financially to put the property to the use for which it has been intended to be put or is restricted, that's not an excuse for changing the use of the property. If that was the case, we would have, you know, if that was the case, we would have 7-Elevens on every corner. We would have our zoning laws.
If we said the only use you can make of this is as a golf course, wouldn't that bring this thing to a head and solve it?
Yes, it would. Yes, to a certain extent, but I think it needs to be. I think Judge Battalion did that in his order to a large extent. He said it needs, the use is as a golf course. I think in his order he said the use is as a golf course. And it must be maintained as a golf course. In the event he doesn't operate as a golf course, he has to maintain it as a golf course. So the answer to your question is, I think Judge Battalion's order is correct. We feel he could have gone the next step and required it to be maintained and operated as a golf course as well, in addition to it just being maintained similar to a golf course. What I think Judge Battalion really said is...
Excuse me, I'm going to catch off here unless there are more questions from the court. How much time do we have for rebuttal then?
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, it may be, and I think it's in Mr. Matika's affidavit, Exhibit 238, I think it's there, that the zoning is identified as agricultural zoning for this property. There is no plat that shows this is a golf course. There are plats that show platted lots on the south side of this property. There are no platted lots on the north side of this property. What I think can be inferred is that someone anticipated there probably would be construction one day on the north side also, and that didn't happen. There was no... I think that all happened before the Greenbelt statutes were even enacted, Your Honor, I think. There was no $400,000 profit. It wouldn't have been in bankruptcy. That would have been a 14-15% return on the sale price. As for this question of whether or not the property owner has not done a good job of taking care of the real estate and hasn't turned on the sprinklers, well, they don't work. They were broken. The pumps didn't work. It hadn't operated successfully. It was a broke property in bankruptcy. Now, as for whether a lien will solve this problem or whether directing that this property be used as a golf course will solve it, well, that'll send it back to bankruptcy. But it won't solve anything else.
But I understand the opposing counsel's argument is that if you buy this property subject to this covenant, you're now under an affirmative duty to maintain it as a golf course until you go broke.
Your Honor, that is their argument. They are attempting to stand in front of all of the forces of the marketplace as though they were a line of tanks holding up a white flag. And unfortunately, the market doesn't display humanity even for a moment. Their approach is unworkable. Thank you.
Thank you. That takes